armed by the United States, trained by the United States for 10 years. A couple of thousand guerrillas showed up, and they all ran away. The generals ran away first, and the soldiers didn't know what to do. They ran away after them.
We have 20 seconds. Hmm? We have 20 seconds.
Well, now, there's basically the effect. It's hard to see how Iraq can even be held together at this point. It's been devastated by U.S. sanctions, the war, the atrocities that followed from it. The current policy, whatever it is not very likely to even patch up. Put Band-Aids on the cancer.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue this discussion tomorrow on Democracy Now! Our guest, Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor Emeritus of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Our website's democracynow.org.
It's 5 p.m. here at KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's the evening news.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the August Wilson Monologue Competition. Portland High School students from across the city have been learning their lines and practicing their moves as they prepare to compete in the regional finals of the August Wilson Monologue Competition to be held March 2nd at Portland Center Stage, Girding Theater at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue. This event is free and open to the public. It begins at 7 p.m., but due to its popularity, it is sold out. The event may have rush tickets available on the night of the event. Again, March 2nd at Portland Center Stage, Girding Theater at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a police killing of a homeless man in Los Angeles has once again raised the question of the excessive use of force by police.
Supporters of bees and butterflies descend on Washington to demand action to protect our nation's food supply.
A Hindu temple in Washington and a mosque in Houston are the latest victims of anti-Muslim attacks.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 2nd, 2015. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. A video posted on Facebook today appears to show the moment a homeless man was shot dead by Los Angeles police officers yesterday morning. The shooting was captured on video by a bystander. Commander Andrew Smith of the LAPD said officers were responding to a 911 call reporting a possible robbery. Smith said the victim began fighting and physically resisting the officers when they approached him. The officers used a taser to try to take him into custody, but Smith claimed that was ineffective. Smith said that at some point a struggle over one of the officers' weapons occurred and the shooting followed. Three police officers fired at the man, who was pronounced dead at the scene. In the video, a group of officers can be seen scuffling with two people. One man is held on the floor and repeatedly punched while apparently being hit by the taser. "Drop the gun," can be heard being shouted before five or six shots ring out. The camera's view is obscured by another police officer who is restraining another person involved in the altercation. Based on the video, Smith said it was unclear what the officers told the man before they fired. He said investigators would use audio enhancement software to determine exactly what was said and when. For more, we go to FSRN's Larry Buell in Los Angeles.
Details are emerging about the death of a homeless man shot by three Los Angeles police officers on the city's Skid Row Sunday. A bypasser captured the incident on video, which went viral on social media almost immediately. LAPD says the officers, one of whom is a sergeant, were responding to the report of a robbery and that one of the officers used a stun gun to subdue the man. Police Chief Charlie Beck said the stun gun failed to subdue him and the victim reached for one of the officer's guns. On the video, five apparent gunshots could be heard, presumably all from police officers. Three officers fired at the man and two of them were wearing body cameras. Police say that any video captured by body cameras and local surveillance cameras will be considered in the investigation. Officials have not released the victim's name, but those who know him say he went by Africa. Pete White is the co-executive director of the LA Community Action Network, a homeless advocacy group in Skid Row. He says it's essential for the community to hold the police accountable and to ask questions.
I anticipate the result of this, if community residents don't get involved, will be to sweep this under the rug. It will be yet another case of the police department saying, we were right, they were wrong, this is what you're paying me for.
The DA's office and the LA Police Commissioner's Inspector General are conducting independent investigations to determine if the officers violated policy. Tents and cardboard shelters cover the sidewalks of Skid Row, where there's a history of tension between the residents and the LAPD. A high percentage of homeless people there struggle with mental illness and addiction. Skid Row residents familiar with Africa say the man had spent time in a mental institution. The LAPD has a special force trained to de-escalate situations involving the mentally ill. Why the LAPD didn't deploy special officers to the scene is just one of many questions yet to be answered. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Attorneys for the city of Cleveland, Ohio, responding to a wrongful death lawsuit on behalf of the family of Tamir Rice, allege that the 12-year-old was responsible for his own death. The response was filed on Friday, barely a month after Rice family attorneys entered a 71-page complaint against the two police officers involved in the boy's death and against the city of Cleveland. On November 22, 2014, two Cleveland police officers responded to reports of a person with a gun at an area park. Video footage shows that within 2 seconds of exiting the police cruiser, one of the officers shot at Tamir Rice, killing him. The 9/11 tape later revealed that the caller said he thought the gun was being brandished by a juvenile and was probably fake. Video footage from a surveillance camera near the scene showed that it took nearly 4 minutes before any first aid was administered to Tamir Rice, who lay bleeding on the ground. The video footage also shows Tamir Rice's 14-year-old sister running to him after he was shot, but she was tackled by an officer, handcuffed, and hauled to a police car. The report filed by the Rice family attorneys also showed that the two policemen stood around and did not appear concerned after shooting the 12-year-old. The attorneys also alleged that one of the officers had been previously dismissed from a smaller department and should not have been hired by the Cleveland police. The City of Cleveland attorneys wrote in their filing that the death of Tamir Rice was directly and approximately caused by his failure to exercise due care to avoid injury. Walter Madison, an attorney for the Rice family, told the Cleveland Plain Dealer that a 12-year-old died unnecessarily at the hands of Cleveland police officers, and he believes that certain officers shouldn't have been entitled to wear the uniform. The Sheriff's Department has yet to determine if either officer will be charged. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder went to Cleveland in December to announce that the Department of Justice had found approximately 600 examples of systemic deficiencies, inadequate training, and ineffective policies within the City of Cleveland Police Department between 2010 and 2013.
The United States Department of Justice is expected to release a report on the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department sometime this week. The DOJ concluded that the Ferguson Police Department has practiced discriminatory practices that create a culture of racial animosity prior to the shooting death of black teenager Michael Brown last summer. The conclusions are the result of a federal investigation that lasted several months. Law enforcement officials briefed on the report, speaking under anonymity, told the New York Times that the department is charged with disproportionately ticketing and arresting African Americans and relying on the fines to balance the city budget. A recent report by the Missouri Attorney General in 2013 says blacks accounted for 86% of the traffic stops in Ferguson, although they only comprised 63% of the population. Also, black drivers were searched twice as often as white drivers. The Ferguson Police Department is 95% white. Reports last month indicate that the DOJ will not bring charges of civil rights violations against Ferguson officer Darren Wilson. However, the federal probe does examine the broader practices of the department in order to give context for the shooting. Recently, citizens of Ferguson and nearby Jennings, Missouri, have filed suits charging the cities with extortionary policing practices, saying that by deliberately jailing residents who are unable to pay traffic tickets and other fines, has turned the jails into debtors' prisons. The DOJ report says that such practices provide a financial incentive to continue unfairly targeting African Americans. The New York Times says that this damning report will likely force the city to either negotiate a settlement with the DOJ or face being sued by the DOJ on civil rights charges.
Protesters gathered on Saturday in Pasco, Washington, calling for justice for Antonio Zambrano Montes, who was killed by police 3 weeks ago. Dozens of residents marched 17 blocks for the 17 shots that were fired by Pasco police at Zambrano Montes. The cell phone video of the shooting went viral on the internet and has outraged people across the country. The video shows Zambrano Montes raising his arms and attempting to surrender to police and being shot at close range by multiple officers. Following the march, residents spent Saturday afternoon in the park calling for solutions and demanding answers from police. Zambrano Montes was killed on February 10th by police in the city of Pasco, located in eastern Washington's agricultural center. He was accused of throwing rocks at the police and then trying to flee. Police fired 17 bullets, seven of which hit Zambrano Montes, resulting in his death.
Portland was host to the fourth Economics of Happiness conference this past weekend. The conference was inspired by a film of the same name produced by the International Society for Ecology and Culture. Like the film, the conference shared many key aspects of global economic relocalization efforts. Andrew Geller was there and filed this report.
It would be easy, perhaps expected, to imagine that a conference focused on fixing the myriad of problems caused by the global economy would be a depressing affair, heavy on statistics and charts, and dire in presentation. But not this event, which focused on local-scale solutions and made abstract concepts feel tangible, achievable, and applicable anywhere for a very simple reason.
Everywhere the story was the same, that in every community, every city, the basic threats from so-called economic development, so-called growth, were identical.
Helena Norberg Hodge is the founder and director of Local Futures and a pioneer in the New Economy movement. She produced and directed the documentary, The Economics of Happiness.
At the same time, we could everywhere see that there's a response to that, where people are starting, sometimes subconsciously, to rebuild the local fabric, the local community fabric, the local businesses, especially local food economies. When we can show this to people, the difference between these localized, more human scale, more ecologically adapted, more culturally adapted, more inclusive, more empowering alternatives, this is very inspiring, and it shows us that clearly it's the antidote to most of the serious crises.
And while there was plenty of talk about these crises, economic concentration, environmental and cultural destruction, loss of local control, poor opportunities for young people, the speakers were uniformly optimistic.
What if not knowing is a resource that we've not come to terms with?
Bayo Akomolafe is an ethno-psychotherapeutic researcher from Covenant University in Nigeria and coordinator of the International Alliance for Localization.
Could it be that even the smallest actions count in ways our system change dynamics are blind to? What if we could treat the unknown, the unthinkable, beyond data, as a resource instead of an inconvenience? We do not know how to resolve our current crisis, how to bring about a more beautiful world. We cannot tell with absolute certainty whether strategy is preferable to being in the moment, or whether the North and South should indeed work together, or what it means to have a paradigm shift happen. It is perhaps unresolvable in principle. We do not understand why we live in a world like this. And even though we have incredible conceptual and critical tools, we do not know how to come out of it, out of this mess we're in, or even if coming out of it is the right question. It seems that the more we try to transcend the system, the more we behave like it.
And according to conference speaker Manish Jain, there's an excellent reason for this. It's school. Manish coordinates Shikshantar, the People's Institute for Rethinking Education and Development, and is a co-founder of Swaraj University, India's first dedicated to regenerating local cultures, economies, and ecologies. He calls the modern educational system one of the roots of the problem.
I used to think that the education system was broken and we needed to fix it. Over the years, I have understood it to be a well-running machine for destroying the human conscious, deep human connections, and diverse human creativities. It brands millions of innocent children as failures and renders many diverse ways of knowing and expressing as invisible. The culture of schooling teaches children that learning only happens in the classroom and knowledge is only in textbooks. What is worth knowing is what appears on the black and white examination papers. Today, I would like you to consider the possibility that modern schooling is one of the greatest crimes against humanity.
An hour or so after Manish and Bio, Sandra Lubarsky spoke on the importance of beauty, which may initially seem off-topic.
We live at a time in our culture when beauty has become a trivial value.
Sandra teaches courses on beauty and strategies for re-enchantment as chair of the Goodnight Family Department of Sustainable Development at Appalachian State University in North Carolina.
Many of us, I think, in this room condemn beauty as a distraction from the great unraveling of civilization that's underway. For most of Western history, beauty was understood as fundamental to the structure of the cosmos. In fact, the word cosmos is Greek for the word order. And the kind of order that was assumed was an aesthetic order, an order of harmony and an order of proportion. The story of how beauty was transformed from a fundamental dimension of the cosmos to a personal opinion is part of the story of how we have been talked out of caring for the natural world and talked into caring for this very abstract thing called the economy. Convinced of the deadness of nature and then the triviality of beauty, we moderns have colluded in stripping the natural world of all value except its value as a resource for human purposes.
In her closing talk, Helena Norberg-Hodge incorporated all of these ideas.
There's an intuitive turning towards the magic, the beauty, the mystery, and the life of the natural world, turning towards nature. There is a huge shift going on where we are often in unconscious ways turning back to what ancient nature-based embedded cultures knew all along. That is, we are the natural world. Our polarizing intellect, where we started joining into this fragmented way of looking at the world, that we are separate from nature, that everything else can be understood by slicing it into neat slices, creating this reductionist, fragmented view through which we view the world. We're beginning to turn away from that.
More about the event can be found online at localfutures.org. I'm Andrew Geller, KABU News.
One of the bills discussed in the Oregon State Legislature today was HB 3014, which allows grandparents to have rights to visit and have relationships with children in state custody. Representative Wayne Krieger brought the bill to the House Judiciary Committee today.
For the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. Staff has explained what had taken place. We missed last year when Judge Livingston did the grandparents' rights bill. Passed, I believe, 56-4 in the House, 28-1 in the Senate. So people really understood that the relationships between grandparents and their grandchildren, in some cases, is extremely important to the child, just as we understand that placing children with relatives also can be very beneficial. As you heard, the statute, the change that's in it, is on lines 41, where the 40 and 41 means the legal parent of the child or ward's legal parent, regardless of whether the parental rights of the child, ward's, or legal parents have been terminated. It was kind of strange to me that a grandparent loses your rights as a grandparent or your parent or your designation as a grandparent and are supposed to walk away from your grandchildren because you had a child who did something foolish. And you'll find out probably in your life that you're going to either have a child or somebody close to you, you know, that actually had your child do something wrong and they had their parental rights were taken away. But I think it's extremely important that this now would give the judge, as it did in the original bill, the authority to have the grandparents have a say and possibly have some type of communication with the child. That does not always mean visitation. It might be in writing, it might be a phone or texting or some other way of keeping a relationship that is valued for the child and the grandparents.
Thank you. Thank you. I think this is an important bill. And just to be clear in my mind, if it turned out the grandparent themselves were a dangerous influence or did problematic things, that person's grandparental right could still be terminated too, right? So there's still protections if it's a really toxic relationship.
If you look at the old bill from last year, they have to make a petition to the court, and then if it is in the best interest of the child, the judge then can grant that visitation or contact. It isn't automatically just given.
The bill in question will authorize grandparents to request visitation or other contact or communication with grandchildren when those children are in legal custody of the Department of Human Services. It now moves from the House Judiciary Committee to the full Oregon House for consideration.
This week is National School Breakfast Week. In Oregon, state officials see this as a chance to call attention to programs that connect kids with healthy morning meals. Anti-hunger advocates say Oregon needs more of them and are launching a campaign to raise awareness. KBOO's Cliff Verla has the story in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
This is National School Breakfast Week and a chance for hunger-fighting advocates in Oregon to push for getting more meals to more kids during the school day. Let's Do Breakfast Oregon is a new awareness campaign to encourage more schools to serve breakfast in the first few minutes of first period. Annie Kirshner, with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, says legislation in Salem would allow that without compromising teachers' instructional time. She predicts the bill will pass.
The state is really recognizing that breakfast is a tool to be ready for school in the same way that school books and pencils are, and it's in the best interest for all of us as a community that our kids do well in school.
Other partners for Let's Do Breakfast Oregon are the State Department of Education and the Oregon Dairy Council, which is offering grants to help schools that might need extra equipment for expanding breakfast programs. Districts often start small when they serve breakfast after the bell, instead of in the cafeteria. In McMinnville, what began last year in just one elementary school is branching out to others in the district. Cynthia Hyatt Henry, the Nutrition Services Director, surveyed the first teachers and staff members who tried it, and 86% gave it their recommendation.
They also said that it reduced the number of trips to the nurse's station, that it increased the students' attention span. I think about half of them said it reduced the number of tardies. I mean, you couldn't really ask for better results.
She says the McMinnville district is now serving 30,000 more breakfasts since setting a goal a year ago to give more kids in need a healthy morning meal. For KBOO News, I'm Cliff Verla. Thank you.
You're listening to John Coltrane on the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:45 for an interview with Ali McCracken of Code Pink about that group's protest against the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee meeting going on right now in Washington, D.C. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, Host Adam Carpinelli will interview Dan Shea, a longtime activist for human rights, anti-war, Latin American solidarity, GI resistance, and more. The discussion will focus on the intersections of the prison and military industrial complexes. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's show features Maurice Carney from Friends of the Congo speaking about hip-hop, social justice, and the Congo. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 57 and a 0% chance of rain. The warmest winter on record continues in Oregon with another record set during February, the warmest February on record in the state of Oregon. The Federal Climate Prediction Center says it's likely that March will continue the trend of this winter so far with unusually high temperatures and unusually low amounts of rain. Today in history, on March 2, 1917, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia abdicated the throne, paving the way for the Bolshevik Revolution and 70 years of communism in Russia. After 300 years of rule by the Romanov dynasty, Tsar Nicholas II was forced to step down following declining popularity due to the Bloody Sunday massacre, when palace guards shot and killed defenseless demonstrators marching on the Winter Palace. The quote of the day is from Bolshevist leader V.I. Lenin, who wrote in 1901, quote, "In a country ruled by an autocracy with a completely enslaved press, in a period of desperate political reaction in which even the tiniest outgrowth of political discontent and protest is persecuted, the theory of revolutionary Marxism suddenly forced its way into the censored literature before the government realized what had happened."
It's 5:25. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
My dictionary defines a staff as a walking stick used either for balance or as a weapon. So how are today's congressional staffs used? At one time, they were behind-the-scenes people hired to walk lawmakers through the complexities of legislation or to help them find balance between competing viewpoints. These days, though, top staffers tend to be a specific type of high-profile operative, corporate lobbyists. At the urging of House Speaker John Boehner, members are bringing the K Street lobbying crowd directly inside their offices and committees to run America's lawmaking process. There's nothing subtle about the intent. These staffs are weapons for knocking aside the public interest and advancing the narrow legislative interests of their former corporate clients. Yes, the same corporations that generously fund the campaigns of Boehner's Republican majority. Neat, huh? As the excellent investigative digger Lee Fong recently detailed in The Nation, the conflict of interest in this hat-switching scheme is a brazen, insolent affront to our democratic ideals and to any sense of ethics. Examples range from the new staff director of the Intelligence Committee, who comes straight from lobbying for such intelligence contractors and profiteers as General Dynamics, Boeing, and the infamous Blackwater outfit, to a leading anti-minimum wage lobbyist for retail giants like Walmart, who has now been embedded as a top staffer inside the troika of House leaders. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's bad enough that our laws have been corrupted by unlimited corporate spending on their army of influence peddlers, but now we taxpayers have the added insult of having to foot the bill for the horde of lobbyists who've quietly been slipped inside to serve as staffers. They're not there merely to influence lawmakers, but to become the de facto unelected corporate Congress.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The Houston office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations today issued a community safety alert to Houston Muslims after an apparent threat was posted on social media. The threat was about an upcoming lecture at the Masjid Hamza Islamic Center in southwest Houston. An anonymous person posted that, quote, "Islam should be outlawed in the U.S. I'll be there to make sure you do not enjoy your event. See you soon," unquote. Mosque officials immediately reported the message to the Houston Police Department and the FBI. The head of Houston's Council on American-Islamic Relations said In this time of increased anti-Muslim sentiment and a spike in incidents targeting Islamic institutions nationwide, the Muslim community must take threats like these very seriously. The center pointed out that numerous threats and hate incidents were reported in the last 3 weeks targeting mosques, Islamic schools, and Muslim communities in Texas, Oklahoma, Iowa, Ohio, Illinois, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, California, Washington, and other states. Another mosque in Houston was the target of an arson attack last week, which burned several buildings. Houston police have not yet declared the arson to be a hate crime, but officials at the mosque say they believe it's very likely they were targeted for their religious belief.
In Washington state, a Hindu temple was the subject of hate graffiti this past month. The Hindu Temple and Cultural Center of Bothell, Washington, was spray-painted with the words, "Get Out," and a swastika. A nearby high school was spray-painted the same night with the words, "Muslims, Get Out." Leaders from the Hindu, Christian, and Muslim communities held a news conference last week calling for an investigation of the incident. Photo documentation of the hate graffiti was provided to the Snohomish County Sheriff's Department and Bothell Police Department. Leaders of the Hindu temple said that the graffiti appears to fit a pattern of increased hate-motivated crimes nationwide, targeting persons and property associated or perceived to be associated with Islam in the American Muslim community. There is no connection between the Hindu in Muslim communities, but whoever painted the graffiti may have gotten the two confused. Washington State has seen incidents like this in the past. In 2012, a Sikh temple that was under construction was burned to the ground by an arsonist who apparently thought the temple was connected to Islam. After the most recent incident in Bothell, Washington, the head of Council of American Islamic Relations for the state said that law enforcement authorities must send a strong message that people of all faiths, races, and ethnicities belong here, and our children can go to school and places of worship without fear of bullying or hate-motivated violence.
Bees and other pollinators may be getting some help soon from President Obama and the Environmental Protection Agency. Today, petitions with over 500,000 signatures were delivered, asking the federal government to take swift and meaningful action to protect the insects that make our food supply possible. The petitions call on the government to regulate the use of a type of pesticides known as neonicotinoids, which have been linked to bee deaths. They're also asking for upgrades to the reporting system that keeps track of bee and bird die-offs and improvements in the oversight of neonic use in seed coatings. Neonicotinoids affect bee cognitive functions that make it possible for bees to forage, communicate, and find their way back to their hives. The neonics poisons entire plants, including the nectar and pollen, and the effects last for months or even years in the plant, soil, and waterways. Some groups are forming to encourage consumers to start asking big box plant retailers if their plants are free of neonics. For more information, KBOO's Rosalind Scott spoke with Lorianne Bird, Environmental Health Director at the Center for Biological Diversity.
Would you tell us about the petitions that you're going to be delivering to President Obama and the Environmental Protection Agency?
Yes. Two exciting things actually happened today. First, a coalition of conservation groups submitted over 500,000 petitions to the White House Pollinator Task Force, asking for them to take bold action to protect pollinators. Also today, almost 130 groups, a letter to the White House and USDA and EPA, asking them to take certain specific substantive protections to protect bees and other pollinators from bee-killing pesticides.
This will be directed at mainly the commercial growers in the United States if they do take an action?
The action would not be directed at growers or sellers or anything like that. It would be action to regulate neonicotinoids in a different way. Neonicotinoids are the bee-killing insecticides that we've heard so much about. So we call them neonicotinoids or neonics. So things that we're calling for specifically, they wouldn't be actions that would necessarily be targeting a grower or a seller, but it would certainly affect them. So, like, for example, one of the things that we're calling for
is a strengthening of risk assessment requirements or additional oversight of the conditional registration process that allows these kinds of dangerous pesticides to come to the market without full review, with the idea that they'll be fully reviewed later on. And oftentimes these products will stay on the market for years and years, and in this case can even cause really significant harm to bees, butterflies, birds, and other kinds of species while not actually ever going through a complete registration process, just going through conditional registration.
So currently, are there no regulations on the neonics?
Oh, no, there are regulations. So all pesticides are regulated in the United States under our federal pesticide law, but the regulations are not strong enough and have led to this situation where we now have neonicotinoids causing really significant population-level damage to both commercial honeybees and native bees.
And have the neonics been banned in other countries?
Yes. The European Union actually 2 years ago took a look at what beekeepers were reporting and took a look at the science and decided that it was time to take action on neonicotinoids. And they implemented a two-year ban on neonics, and that ban has been really successful.
So they do have some studies going during that two-year period that show that it has made a difference?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And one of the arguments that industry often makes is that this will harm yields, and the evidence coming out of Europe is that, in fact, there are no changes to yields. And that's a really common misconception. So about 95% of the total landmass on which neonicotinoids are used is actually them being used as a seed coating, which means that every single seed, like 99% of all corn seeds, and the vast majority of seeds used in commercial agriculture are treated with the neonicotinoid seed coating. So the seeds are treated with the insecticide, and then they're planted, and then the whole plant essentially is a systemic insecticide. The pollen, the nectar, every part of the plant is then insecticidal and is harmful to a wide array of non-target species. And a lot of times farmers aren't necessarily wanting that seed treatment, but that's just kind of what's available. And so they've been stuck with it. And actually earlier this year, the federal government issued a report finding that neonicotinoid seed coatings on soybeans actually did nothing for the soybeans. They didn't improve yields. They didn't in any way do anything for the farmers. So that was really important study, and we anticipate additional studies on corn and other major crops that are treated with these insecticides.
Are the plants that most of the homeowners are, if they're buying plants for their yard, their residence, do these plants have neonicotinoids on them also?
Very often, yes. Not always, but it certainly is often the case that a plant will be pre-treated with neonicotinoids. And this is especially tragic when it's a plant that a homeowner is planting specifically because it's labeled as a pollinator attractor. So you're essentially purchasing a plant to attract pollinators, and then the pollinators are lured in, and then they die or they suffer subacute impacts as a result of visiting that plant that you bought to attract them.
Do they have any symbols on the plant tags that'll tell you if the plant is free of neonicotinoids?
For the longest time, no. And as a result of a major campaign by a variety of groups, we've now gotten Home Depot and Lowe's to put a label on plants that says this plant has been treated with neonicotinoids. We've had some limited success, but certainly not all plants are labeled, and a lot of times people just don't know. So it's great if when people go to their local nursery, they let the nursery owners know that they will not buy plants that are treated, and they need to know for certain that a plant has not been treated with neonicotinoids.
Is it too late for our listeners to help by signing the petition?
No, please. We'd love it if they would. Listeners can sign the petition by going to www.save-bees.org, and they can take action to sign the petition now.
We were speaking with Lorianne Bird, the Environmental Health Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. This is Rosalind Scott for KBOO News.
The public comment period for federal protection of the monarch butterfly ended today. More than a half million people submitted comments calling on the government to protect the monarch butterfly under the Endangered Species Act. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service now has 9 months to determine whether to propose protections for the monarch. Populations of the iconic orange and black butterfly have declined by 90% in the last 20 years. The agency's review of the monarch was spurred by a legal petition filed in August by the Center for Food Safety, the Center for Biological Diversity, the Xerces Society, and renowned monarch scientist Dr. Lincoln Brower. These experts all submitted comments today renewing their call for the agency to list the monarch butterfly as threatened. In September, the service announced a positive initial finding on the petition and determined that Endangered Species Act protection for the monarch butterflies may be warranted. The petition has been resoundingly supported by monarch experts, legislators, and the public. Last month, the Fish and Wildlife Service announced that it will provide a total of $3.2 million to support monarch conservation projects. But biologists who study the monarch say that this amount falls short of the funding needed to restore enough monarch habitat to ensure the butterfly's future. As detailed in a new report from Center for Food Safety, the butterfly's dramatic decline is being driven in large part by the widespread planting of genetically engineered crops in the Midwest, where most of the monarchs are born. The vast majority of genetically engineered crops are made to be resistant to Monsanto's Roundup herbicide, a potent killer of milkweed, the monarch caterpillar's only food. The dramatic surge in Roundup use with Roundup-ready crops has virtually wiped out milkweed plants in Midwestern corn and soybean fields. In the past 20 years, it is estimated that these once common orange and black butterflies may have lost more than 165 million acres of habitat, an area about the size of Texas, including nearly a third of their summer breeding grounds.
New highly radioactive leaks from the stricken Fukushima nuclear power plant were recently revealed by TEPCO, the plant's owner. TEPCO has admitted that radioactive water, more than 7,000 times higher than previous readings, was flowing into the ocean from a drainage ditch near Unit 1 and from the rooftop of Unit 2. TEPCO also admitted that they knew of the leaks for almost a year and withheld the information from the Japanese Nuclear Regulation Agency, the Japanese Fisheries Agency, and the public. One source of the new leaks is believed to be nuclear fuel on the rooftop of Unit 2. The Unit 2 reactor exploded in the aftermath of the tsunami and ejected fuel core materials into the environment. Larger pieces are still on the rooftop of the reactor, where it mixes with rain before flowing down the gutters onto the ground. Another leak is believed to be from molten corium, flowing out of the basement containment area of Unit 1, mixing with groundwater before flowing into the Pacific Ocean, located just yards away. TEPCO admitted they knew of the leaks for almost a year and withheld the information, causing an uproar from area fishermen and the fisheries agency. TEPCO officials met with the fisheries agency, apologized for the non-disclosure, and stated they plan to attempt to remove the reactor core materials from the rooftop of Unit 2 by the end of March. TEPCO also said it was working on a plan to keep radioactive rainwater gathering in a nearby drainage ditch from flowing directly into the ocean, but no firm plans have been developed yet. The non-disclosure of the new ongoing radioactive leaks is just one of several recent problems that continue to haunt the Fukushima nuclear power plant, which suffered multiple melted reactors during the 2011 Japanese earthquake and tsunami. Two employees working on the cleanup have died in recent months from accidents, and dozens have been hurt. Reactor Unit Number 3 continues to belch radioactive steam every few months. TEPCO still does not know with any degree of certainty where the melted fuel cores from the four reactors are. Radioactivity levels are still too high for even robots to enter the reactor buildings to locate the fuel cores, much less begin to clean up and decommission the nuclear power plant.
Several new, large craters have formed in Siberia, causing scientists to be concerned that global warming is beginning to unleash methane trapped in the Siberian permafrost. The craters are each more than 100 feet in diameter and are believed to result from explosions caused by the permafrost melting and releasing large amounts of methane, a highly explosive gas. Scientists studying the craters are not sure when or why the explosions occur, placing them in danger as they study the warming permafrost. The craters are located in an area containing vital oil wells. Last year, only 2 craters were found. This year, several more have been found, and scientists believe there are dozens, if not hundreds, of the new craters in Siberia alone. Methane is considered a greenhouse gas and is 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide at warming the planet. Leading climate scientists are worried that the emerging methane craters are a sign of runaway global warming and warn that if a large amount of the methane trapped in the world's permafrost were to be released due to global warming, it would make warming rates exponentially worse.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for Monday, March 2nd, 2015. Nonviolent actions organized against West Bank settlement and political detainees held by Israel announced protest moves. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of nonviolent resistance activists gathered on Monday morning in Khalit al-Nahla area near Bethlehem City in southern West Bank. Mohammed Mahaysen, coordinator of the Popular Resistance Committee, said that the protesters marched in the area carrying Palestinian flags and posters containing names of villages Israel destroyed in 1948 and expressed their rejection to Israel's ongoing violations of international law. Mahaysen said that Israel is now trying to build Givat Etam colony on more than 420 acres of Palestinian lands in the area, adding that Tel Aviv initially approved the plan in 2004. The official warned that this